designed to encourage, empower, and educate real estate professionals by sharing best practices from business leaders that are proven winners. I'm your host, Kyle Malnati, and this is Calibrate Real Estate.
Broadcasting from the Mile High City, thank you for tuning in to the Calibrate Real Estate podcast. I'm your host, Kyle Malnati, and this is the podcast designed to encourage, empower, and educate real estate professionals across the globe. My guest today is actually a client, Kira Golden from Direct Source Wealth. Kira is based in Puerto Rico, is where the company is based, but she's done real estate transactions literally across the globe. And Kira, thank you for joining us today on the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So what we're going to be talking about, yeah, you're welcome. And I'm so glad to be having the discussion. So we just did a deal. Kira is the CEO of Direct Source Wealth, and she syndicates real estate transactions. This particular property ended up being an infill land site that may end up becoming an assemblage and getting sold as a larger package deal. But Kira, you got to start in real estate just like every one of us. There's probably a story behind it. How did you get into the real estate investing world, and what made you crazy enough to decide that you wanted to do real estate investments?
I mean, like so many people, I have to, you know, give a tip of the hat to Robert Kiyosaki. But, you know, before he even wrote Rich Dad, Poor Dad, he was selling investment advice on infomercials. And I was a young infomercial junkie. So 12 years old, you know, up at 2 a.m. watching infomercials. And Robert Kiyosaki gets on and talks about how inflation is eating away at your money. And I'm going, no, not my $3,000 in the bank, you know, not my birthday money. Really, it convinced me that there was no better time to take significant risk than when you're really, really young. I kind of always figured that if I went out there, played hard, screwed up really bad by the time I was, you know, 20 and I started over, I'd be no worse than everybody else. So that kind of gave me the confidence to just try it. And then I was very, very lucky and persistent. And found, you know, a real estate agent that, you know, took me seriously at 18, you know, with my little savings to go buy a house, and a lender who was willing to work with me, and kind of started from there and just kept growing.
So what types of deals do you do? Obviously, real estate investing can span so many different areas. I specialize in the sale of multifamily properties, land, and other commercial property in Denver. But what are the types of deals that you're putting together? And without disclosing the identity of anybody, who are the types of people that you invest with?
Yeah. So typically, we're differentiating ourselves from a lot of other real estate investment companies out there in that we aren't picking a particular vertical. Our objective is to really raise awareness of the industry and create a professional platform. So we work with what we call local area operators. So these are generally people who specialize in whether it's multifamily housing or vertical ground up building or storage units or whatnot. And we GP with them. We partner with them to bring deals to our investor base that allow our investors to have a diversified portfolio. So rather than having to work with four or five different companies, an investor can come and work with us and pick, you know, different geographical regions, different asset classes, and build a diversified investment portfolio.
And I think the best part too is it sounds like when you have people that are investing in some of the funds that you create, you're enabling them to make their money appreciate. Basically, they're going to get a return on investment. And some of these folks are not going to be as experienced as you are, so you're helping benefit their retirement portfolio by getting them involved in deals, and you're the one who ends up putting them together, and they end up being able to be profitable. And like I say a lot in my business, that the way to create wealth yourself is creating value for other people, and being able to syndicate these investments and put these deals together really makes a lot of people happy because they're getting great returns, and you're basically creating it's not literally a mutual fund, but you're mutually funding this investment with people from all across the world.
Yeah, so we definitely we try to stay away from the fund model per se. I really like direct investment. That's why it's our name. Direct source is about, you know, directly sourcing deals. I think that one of the problems when the last market really crashed is that too many people were emotionally removed from what they were investing in. You know, if you ask someone what companies they own in a mutual fund, most people have no clue. They might know the top two or three holdings, but even that would be a surprise. So part of our process is really about educating and shifting the way people relate to their money and being having them be connected to what they're invested in and know that they're making a difference with the difference with the tenants that we have in our properties or in the communities where we're invested in. And you know, we started doing that long before, you know, impact management became sort of a buzzword or impact investing. And I respect all the people who are operating under that umbrella. But to me, there's no reason to differentiate. Good investing is about doing things that make a difference and make an impact. And that helps the bottom line. And it helps our investors feel really good about what they're doing. And you're right. Most of our investors are fairly passive. They're executives. They're successful in their particular field and don't have the time or inclination to directly manage real estate, but want the benefit of being a direct investor.
Well, I love that distinction. That's something I learn the different ways that people invest in real estate all the time. And direct is a new thing for me. And so it's really cool to hear that that's an option out there. The other part that I really love is that you talk about impact. And I think that when people lose sight of the impact that they're making, and it sounds really altruistic, but the impact that they're making on the world through whatever they're doing, whether it's real estate investing or, you know, it's easy to think of a firefighter as making an impact, but people that are investing in real estate and making the community that they're in better, whether it's through commercial or residential, it's really a big deal. And so I think that you've got the right perspective there on using that word impact. I like that a lot.
Thank you.
The next question I have for you is that I've come to find out through working with you that you're a mom. You've got a young son, and then you're also pregnant with one on the way. And I just, you know, I really respect working parents. I'm a working parent, but my wife, Courtney, we have the fortune of having her be able to stay home. She worked through our first pregnancy and then went back to work. And then when we had our twins, we decided that, gosh, daycare was going to be gobbling up any salary that she was going to make anyways. And she wanted to stay at home. So I really respect working moms. And I kind of wonder, how do you fit it all in? I know that you're constantly traveling all across the world. You've got a company based in Puerto Rico, but obviously you do a deal here in Colorado. You do deals in Arizona. You're jet setting all over the place. How do you fit it in? How do you find time to make all this work?
Yeah, it's funny you say that. So, you know, as far as the flying all over part, you know, a lot of that is, I think, perception. Certainly early on in the business, I had to do a lot of that. But we have a phenomenal team. And if it wasn't for my team, it wouldn't work. You know, they do a lot of the heavy lifting and the walking the sites and things that I used to do before having children. You know, I wouldn't buy a property that I didn't sleep in. I mean, even if we bought something in the ghetto, I'd spend a night there before, you know, but not before we bought it, but right after we bought it. And so, you know, some of my kind of quirky ideals, fortunately, there's the next generation coming up of 20 somethings who are willing to do the travel and do the heavy lifting. And then I'm able to really manage a lot more behind the scenes, which makes this possible. The other thing is just a question of priorities. I mean, when I decided to start Direct Source Wealth, it was the company was ironically founded officially 1 year to the day before my first son was born, so April 30th. But I really didn't start getting active with it until after my son was born. And it really starts with my children being the priority and then figuring out how to make the business work around that. So right now, I manage a lot of my work schedule around nap times, or you might see an email from me at 2 a.m, or, you know, I do a lot when they're sleeping and, or, you know, at a play date or whatnot. And, you know, that limits our growth somewhat, but that's the trade-off. And when they get into school, I'll hit the pedal to the metal again, but there's never enough time to get everything done. So you just pick what matters most and do that first and then fit the rest in as much as you can.
I love it. It's a classic Stephen Covey, you know, prioritize things with your big rocks, put that in first and then the rest of it's just going to naturally fall in, or it won't, because it's not important. And I remember when our twins were born, The early morning feeding, and it sounds like we have animals or something, but when they would get fed early in the morning, they would typically wake up between 3 o'clock and 4 o'clock. I would handle that feeding because I'm an early riser. My wife is kind of our night owl. And so I'd let her sleep and I'd feed them, burp them, get them all ready. And believe me, my wife was doing her fair share. So this was my little part in the whole thing. But then after that, I'm like, I'm awake. I'm not going back to sleep at four. And so I would just start working. And that really adopted a habit out of necessity, really, to say, like, I would start returning emails at 4:30 and 5 o'clock. And I would get this reputation in the industry for being like one of the hardest workers ever. Because people would see these emails. And I'm like, it's just because I have kids. You know?
Little do they know you're napping at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, right? To catch up.
Totally. Yeah, exactly. So fun stuff. Well, that's great. And what are the types of activities that you do, just prioritizing things to start your day right? Do you have a morning ritual that, and I know that kids obviously take that off kilter, but do you have a morning ritual that you like to do?
You know, I am, and finally admitting it to myself, I am like an anti-ritual person. I mean, I know all the great teachings about how to be successful are all about, you know, get up, make your bed first thing, you know, do your, I've never been any good at that. So I just, my morning ritual, you know, is like brush my teeth and check my phone. one thing I do say, I do think I do well is, you know, I don't manage by, urgency, I manage by priority. So where people can get off track is when you get a bunch of, you know, morning emails, they're urgent, everything seems like a fire. And then half your day is gone and you don't know what you did. I've over the years have developed the ability to really put the fire in perspective, let it burn sometimes if it has to, because I want to solve the underlying problem. And I would say if there's anything sort of systematic or ritual that I do, it's training my brain to look at every opportunity or what some people might call problems as a chance to develop a systematic solution. So I never want, it's a failure if I've put out the fire, but I haven't created a system or a process to avoid it again. You know, so one fire happening, that's okay. That's how you learn. You don't expect things. They come at you, you solve them. But if the same thing happens more than once, that's an issue.
Absolutely. And I think that I really appreciate the refreshing concept of you saying, hey, look, I've learned that that's not me. It's not me to set up, get right up and do yoga or do meditation or whatever. It's kind of like, look, the day is going to approach me the way it does. But I love the fact that you break down that a lot of people, especially when it comes to email and correspondence in our working world today, that feels like someone else's needs create urgency for you. And I love how you really put that in the right perspective. I heard a speaker talk about this, that, you know, basically your email inbox is the summation of everybody else's needs, not your own. And so every time, if you start your day by opening up your email box and just start firing away at everybody's urgent emails, all of a sudden you're going to get a whole batch of responses and never get what you want to have accomplished done. So it's a priority delusion is what ends up happening. So I think that that's a great refreshing remark to saying, look, you put things in a priority and then you also set your day up for you to work well. And I think that's important. Just because someone else wakes up early and does something different doesn't mean that that's going to be working for you. And I think it's a good message to our audience that you've got to set your day up for you to win. And you said that earlier with how you set up your schedule and how you set up your business, that it's going to be catered around what you are right now, which is a mom of a young toddler and then one on the way. And so you've just got to make sure that things are in the right perspective.
Yeah. And part of that is communication. I mean, that's been huge is, you know, we all feel, especially moms, but probably working dads too, like we're never doing enough, we're failing. And what can come with that is a feeling of shame, which leads to isolation and non-communication. And so one thing that my younger sisters actually really helped me with is just getting really straight with people. Like I think you and I had something, we had something scheduled and I'm like, yep, I fell asleep for a 30-minute nap that turned into a 4-hour nap. You know, I don't feel the need to make a lie or an excuse. And I don't want to deal with people who only want to hear about the fluffy part of life. You know, I tell people like it is. You know, if I can't get back to them in a week or two, I'll tell them that. So that they're empowered to make a decision that works for them. You know, I feel like anything other short of that is a little manipulative.
I agree with you. And I mean, true story, that actually happened just a few days ago. And it was no big deal. I wasn't bent out of shape or anything. I just wanted to make sure I didn't miss. I was frankly kind of wondering, I'm like, did I get the date or the time messed up? And then I saw your email. I'm like, I totally get it. I've had a pregnant wife before. I totally understand. You know, nap time is very, very important. And to put this into perspective, as we film this, you're just a few weeks away from your delivery date. So, I mean, you're like in the final stages of the third trimester. So sleep is real important when you can get it. So I love that. So society today, you know, we've got this love-hate relationship with technology, right? We just talked about how email can be other people's priorities and put things, you know, their fires are putting your day off kilter if you're not managing it correctly. But there's benefits, right? And I would imagine that a high-producing, very successful person like yourself has got some technology hacks that you like to use. What are the things, whether they're personally or professionally, that you like to use in technology?
I've been thinking about this question because I do consider myself fairly technological, but I also don't, you know, when you get used to using something, you don't know if it's unusual.
Sure.
But, you know, we do a lot of, actually probably one of my favorite things in the business is Uber Conference. How much time gets wasted weekly on conference calls? You know, three or four people are on the line waiting on one or two to join. Somebody forgets. It's usually me. So Uber Conference has been a great tool that allows us to, they dial out. So you put everybody's phone number in, it sends you a text message reminder 10 minutes before, it calls you. It just makes it very, very hard for somebody to even be 5 minutes late to a call. And starting things on time, anything that's going to promote time management is, I think, critical, because especially as an organization grows, being late, I know it seems minor, but being 5-10 minutes late while other people are sitting around, then they go run off and answer some emails, and now we're 10 minutes late starting a call, it just kills productivity. And so, you know, those kinds of time management tools have been so valuable in keeping our business efficient. And then we're also a virtual company. So, we use a lot of, but I'm also cheap. So we use a lot of like Google services that are part of our Gmail service to share information, share data. I'm just amazed how much there is out there that doesn't cost very much if you're willing to take the time to learn how to use it.
I would say you're thrifty instead of cheap. just a little distinction. And at the same time, I love it. I've never heard of Uber Conference. Now, I don't do a ton of conference calls, but I imagine there's a lot of people in our audience that do. And that's fascinating, because usually the old-fashioned model is someone calls in, they're waiting, you hear the music in the background, and then others join, and you're kind of like, where's the last person? I love the idea that it just dials everybody out. It's proactive, and there you go. And it gets everybody on the line. I love that.
And there's no pin. I hate nothing more than sitting in my car trying to call into a conference call, trying to memorize a 19-digit pin code, you know, so I can get in. And I'm going back and forth between my email and my phone, and drives me crazy. So,
and I will say, from my personal experience, I used to run a conference call before I did Zoom conferences, and the conference call setup, even if you get the pin right and hit pound or the hashtag sign, you end up at half the time not getting into the conference is the other problem too. So you can have it perfectly right, and it's just totally, it bothers me too. So I agree with that. Mm-hmm. You alluded to failure earlier in the discussion. And one of the reasons why I named our company Calibrate Real Estate is that I believe that every success is born out of failure, and that success is ultimately standing on a mountain of failure. And so, but I don't like the F word. I don't like failure. I like think of learning experiences or making mistakes and iterating. So just talk to the audience about how someone like yourself has maybe had some missteps along your career, and what you've done to really handle the mental game behind having a mistake happen and moving on from it.
Yeah. Interestingly enough, most of my business mistakes have been tied to personal relationship, poor judgment. So for example, I was married once previously, and amazing guy, but not like that should never have been a marriage. We ended up separating and eventually divorcing, but separating in 2007 or eight, end of seven, beginning of eight. And I remember I had like three or four single family homes, I bought them all before we got together, but he had been helping me sort of manage and operate them. And then he bailed and the market tanked. And I remember going by to pick up a rent check at my house that I owed $147,000 or so for. And the house across the street was listed for sale for $35,000. And it had an extra bedroom and a pool that I didn't have. And I remember, I picked up the rent check. I drove home, totally just, oh my God, how could he leave me to deal with this by myself? Really feeling down on myself. And I still have the mirror hanging up in my office here. I literally looked at myself in the mirror, like smacked myself around, gave myself a couple of minutes to feel shitty about the situation, and then sat down and said, okay, so what do I do? And I ended up putting an offer and buying the house across the street. And that actually launched into my fix and flip business. Definitely so many people saw the market crash as a failure. I hear all the time people say, I tried real estate and it didn't work. And, but a lot of people walk away too soon. They quit, they give up too early. I can't remember where I'd heard this definition, but failure was defined as not achieving your intended outcome. And if that's the case, I probably failed 10 times before breakfast. But when you think about it that way, then it creates the opening to go, okay, all right, I didn't get my intended outcome. Maybe I could conceive of a better outcome. Like, how could I turn this around and make it even better than I originally expected? Maybe I was thinking too small about my outcome and that's why it didn't work. And so that's been sort of the access to shifting that process. Again, recently I'm going through the situation with my son's father, another legal situation. The poor decision making on the personal front. But it's been amazing. It's been great for business. Going through the whole disclosure process, making sure all our accounting and financial is really tied out and strong. So something that I think most people see as a really traumatic and miserable experience, and a lot of the world has been through it, custody battles and divorce and all this kind of stuff. They've just been opportunities to make me stronger, and I'm grateful for them. And that just makes going through both that experience and professionally and in business, it just makes everything better.
I agree. And that spirit of gratitude, I don't want to get lost on that. I want to really accentuate on that whatever you're going through, you have something positive to be thankful for.
Absolutely.
And I think that often gets me out of my funk whenever I have something going on. I'm like, look, gosh, I lost a listing. It would be a very easy idea, or something major, a divorce, or you lose someone that's really important to you, whether the relationship unravels or they pass away. You've got so many other people in your corner that maybe you forget about at times. And so I love the way that you describe that, and I appreciate your openness and just some of the personal things that you go through. And you had talked about that definition of failure. To kind of flip the coin on the other side, the famous motivator Earl Nightingale talked about success, and he defined it very simply as the progressive realization of a worthy goal or ideal. And the idea there is, I always heard success as reaching your goals, but Earl coined it in his book, in his audio series, he coined it as that progressive realization. So it's like the step-by-step progress, which really opened my eyes. I'd never really thought of success as the journey. And that sounds really like fluffy, right? But it is the journey that's successful.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if you can master, and I'm certainly by no means an expert at this, but it's been part of my journey. It's like if one can master the way that we experience the circumstances around us and dance with them in a way that creates a beautiful outcome for as many people involved as possible, ideally all people, like what more can we want to achieve? And then of course, part of that is like money flows with that, other things flow with that. But like that, that feeling, I mean, really, none of us really, really care about money, even the people who think they do. And none of us really, really care about fame or success. It all comes down, you see it with these guys like with Enron that, when the curtain was pulled back, they felt like frauds and, they killed themselves. It's like, there are a lot of people who are striving for the wrong things. And when really at the end of the day, it's just about like, can I sleep well at night? Do I have like people who love me around me? And if that's happening, then the other things that your heart desires will sort of fall in long tandem with that, I believe.
I completely agree. And that's a perfect way to put that, that it's all about that perspective, that you've got to be comfortable with your decisions and your action. And I think a lot of times people overemphasize money. Money's important for sure.
Sure.
Without it, it's like all of a sudden you don't realize that oxygen's in the air until you're void of it, right? And all
right.
of a sudden you're really panicking. We walk around all day not realizing that we're breathing in oxygen and breathing out carbon dioxide. And all of a sudden, if that was to change, you would know it immediately. So it is important, but it's not the main thing. It's actually just a byproduct of what's necessary, like food and water
right.
and other things. So once you have food and water and or money, it becomes more about your purpose and your priority. Mm-hmm. And I love the way that you described your purpose. I think that that's really great.
Thank you.
So you talked about your team and you talked about being a virtual team. I love the concept of how great leaders work with their teams. And so we just talked about how you handle failure, but let's say a teammate goofs something up and messes it up. How do you handle it? How do you do it while they feel supported? I've had so many situations in my past, and I'll admit this, where I've mishandled someone's mistake. And you often look at your teammate as kind of the summation of their, you know, they're kind of the worst things that are going on, not their best attributes at times. And so you've been successful. How do you work with your team and lead them, even if they're struggling through something?
I generally just fire people and deduct whatever they screwed up from their last paycheck.
I love it. That's
just
great.
Kidding. No, rule of fear and domination. That's the way to get shit done. No, honestly, like in my 20s, that probably is what I did. I mean, I was not the best. I still have a lot to learn. But I feel like I've made strides. And one of the big things was a coaching that came from my older sister, who's a phenomenal leader. In fact, she runs an entire academic foundation called I Lead Education, right? So it's like she's got it going on.
Awesome.
And one of the things she called me out on, she said, you know, people can read on your face how you're feeling about something. And I said, oh, I've got to get better at, you know, hiding that. And she goes, or you could just stop being so judgmental. So it doesn't even show up on your face, you know? And I'm like,
I love that.
Oh, I didn't even think about that as an option. Yeah, maybe I should do that. Or my mom also gave me some critical coaching and leadership, and I'll kind of tie this all together. But, you know, I was complaining in the first year of my business, you know, nobody can fund anything. At the end of the day, they always got to get me on the phone to close the investor. I've always got to do it. You know, my mom listened to me gripe for a little while, and then she looked at me and she said, don't take this the wrong way, but what about your ego makes it important to you that they can't succeed without you?
And I love that.
I was like, nothing. They really can't do it, you know? Like they really, really can't do it. But I was forced to sort of step back and look at it and realize that, yeah, it really was my ego driving it. It was me, you know, wanting to see things done my way. And so over the last few years, what I've gotten much better at in terms of leadership is supporting people and empowering people to define their own objectives. And when they fail, helping them through the emotional process of reframing that failure. And I actually make it into kind of a game and a challenge. It's like, you know, the bigger the mistake you can write off. I mean, we used to make $100 mistakes and it was like, oh my God, you know, and then it's $1,000 mistakes and you're like, oh, I don't know how we're gonna survive this. And now, you know, $50,000 mistake or a $70,000 mistake and you're going, oh my God. But the bigger the problems can be, the bigger the game is you're playing. And framing that in is just part of the solution. So financially, we actually absorb sort of an expected amount of, you know, judgment call errors that cost money. It's the learning curve. It's the tuition check to the university of life, or sometimes called the stupid tax, depending how predictable that outcome was.
I love stupid tax. I mean, I don't love it when it happens, but it is definitely a good term.
Yeah.
And it's planning. It's having margin in your budget.
Yes.
You know, so what ends up happening is I love the topic of margin. I've got a mentor that spoke to me. I'm in the process of writing a book, and he talked to me about just having margin, whether it's a rainy day fund or margin in your time. And what ends up happening is it reminds me of the old adage of margin for error. And so many people assume that something's going to work with zero error.
Right.
And it's just not possible. But everybody creates a business plan assuming everything's going to be up and up and nothing's going to be a problem.
Yep.
And I think as you become experienced, you start to underwrite that. You underwrite, okay, we're probably going to miss something
yep.
in all the projects that we do. I love it.
Absolutely.
So, the other thing that I want to just slow down and make sure that the audience hears is when you're working with teammates, helping them define their objectives. Mm-hmm. And then when it doesn't naturally go the way that they expect, handling their emotions as you guide them through it. I love that. And that's something as a young leader, I'm learning too. And you're absolutely right. It's not creating a quota and cracking the whip and saying, you know, drive to the quota. It's what do you want to accomplish? And if you hear what they want to accomplish and you think it's weak and you're like, this is not going to happen, you can help stretch them as they're yep. creating that objective. But it ends up becoming a shared responsibility to everybody and accountability when they create the objective. Mm-hmm. I love it. So I have a feeling I know the answer to this next question, and it's probably loaded, but because I've just gotten to know you here over the last couple of months, I have the feeling that you are very authentic.
I try
You're
to
very
be.
True to yourself. And I love that. And I think it's very refreshing. My question though is, have you ever felt that your authenticity has made you vulnerable in any way? And do you feel like that's ever backfired?
I hesitate because I don't think of myself as someone who's very good with vulnerability. Like I don't cry in front of people. I don't express, you know, deep emotions or whatnot. Mm-hmm. But the way you worded the question, you know, you're right. Yeah, of course. I mean, you know, even just a simple sort of trivial example, I have a nose ring. And I remember when I started working for Edward Jones, you know, they said, well, you're going to have to take that out. And I said, well, you're going to have to find another employee. you know, and I had a Department of State interview, you know, that I showed up at barefoot. And you know, everybody told me that was going to backfire, but I got offered the position. So, you know, somehow I've allowed my eccentricities have worked okay for me, but of course there's a cost too. I know when I walk into a banker's office, barefoot and pregnant, you know, and, they don't take me as seriously. But so I've also learned how to manage around that vulnerability in business and, hire, you know, attractive 40-year-old men who can go talk to other attractive 40-year-old men and do the thing that they all do together. And that's great, you know? So, you know, I've had a number of men in particular, but people tell me, you know, it's amazing how successful you've been, especially as a woman in this industry. And quite frankly, I find that deeply offensive.
Right.
Because, you know, it's like, yeah, there are certain challenges to being a woman in this business and a very sort of authentic, quirky, hippie one. But there's advantages that come with that too. I know that sometimes I resonate with a seller and I get a building because they like me. And because they feel like they know who I am and there's a bond that's building. And that's, so to me, the benefits outweigh the cost, but yeah, there's certainly cost.
Yeah. I love the way you answered that because you're right. There's going to be a situation where if you're acting true to yourself, true to your values, it's going to backfire because not everybody wants to work with everybody. But I think though that the hidden cost of not being authentic is that you are eroding away at what is genuine and true about yourself.
Yes.
And I think that I love that. And for the audience that has not met Kira, I know from having seen this, that one of her hallmarks, one of the traditions, one of the ways that people know her is that she walks barefoot. And, you know, spending a lot of time in Puerto Rico, that's something that is more socially acceptable. But we walked into a closing and she had no shoes on. And I was like, hey, you got no shoes on. She's like, oh yeah, you didn't know that that's my thing. I'm like, no, I didn't, but that's really cool. Actually, it's really cool.
Yep. Yeah.
So I love it.
You save she a lot practices- of money on shoes that way too.
That's right. Exactly. Just got to have some snow boots for when you're doing deals.
There are
up in
exceptions.
The
there are definitely exceptions.
So, you know, our last couple of questions in closing out our podcast. I always like to ask people what their memorable moments are in real estate, kind of the funny stuff, or like, wow, this was a really big deal, or maybe I was way in over my head, but something happened really great. So do you have an impactful or a memorable experience that you'd love to share about being a real estate investor, and just kind of some stuff that, some tales from the road, if you will?
Yeah. And this is sort of a combination between real estate and just managing other people's money in general, because there's a lot of you out there, I'm sure, who are thinking about syndicating who have the same fear I did, right? So if you consider yourself an honest, ethical, good person, and you know that by doing a deal, you're going to make a crap load of money, and you know that that's going to influence the way you think about the deal, right? So if somebody comes to you and says, hey, should I invest in this? And you're standing to make a $300,000 sponsor fee or $500,000 sponsor fee, you know, any human being is going to be inclined to say, well, yeah, absolutely, you should invest in this. And so there's this moral dilemma that gets created that there's really no way to alleviate completely. But early in my investing career, and this wasn't in real estate, this was with in the more traditional space, the concept maps over, and I've had repeat experiences of this with real estate. But there was an investor who came in and had an annuity. And I don't know if you know anything about annuities, but annuities are great if you're 75 years old and, you know, need income for the rest of your life and don't care if the principal goes to your kids and whatever. But they're terribly tax disadvantaged as an estate planning tool, and they're very expensive. They have a lot of bells and whistles that chip away at the return. So this was a younger client who had inherited an annuity. And if I resold them a new and better annuity, like upgraded the annuity but left them in it, I was going to meet my commission goal for the entire month. If I recommended that they cash out of the annuity and just buy straight, you know, mutual funds or stocks or whatever, I'd hit my commission goal for the week. And I don't know if people know this business, but it's dog eat dog. And if you don't make your goals, you know, early on in your career, you're out. So there was a lot of incentive that was skewing with my ability to make a recommendation. And what I learned is you just tell people that. Like, I literally sat them down and I said, look, I'm having trouble advising you to do one or the other because here's what's in the way for me. And here's what I see as the benefits and the drawbacks. And I showed them my little pro-con list of the one product and the pro-con list of the other. And they ultimately chose to go with the more expensive product that was going to make me a higher commission. And I said, great, you know, what made you choose that? And they said, because we want someone like you around to continue to advise us. And if you're not making enough money for it to work for you, then you can't be here to help us. And it shifted for me my experience of like what it is. Now no longer am I making a profit from managing other people's money. Now what I'm doing is I'm coming alongside them and we're figuring out what works for both of us. And it has to be a win for me so that I can support them. And over the time in real estate, I've had many of investors, I've brought deals to people and said, look, this isn't working the way we expected, or it's losing money, or something's gone wrong and we have to totally reframe it. And that old guilt creeps back up. But my investors constantly remind me that they care about me as much as I care about them, and we're in this together. And that is the most humbling thing. I wouldn't say it's specifically about real estate, but just about working with other people and their livelihood, that's really made an impact on me and shaped the trajectory of what I do.
Wow, that's amazing. And it's true. It's totally true for anybody that's in a commission or is putting something together and ends up getting some sort of finder's fee or funding fee, you do run that risk at times. And I've had several conversations with clients where I said, hey, look, I want to make sure you understand that as I'm giving you advice around this one deal, I'm going to make this, and this other deal, I'm going to make that. And I'm not saying it to focus it on me, but I want to make sure you understand that, like, there is a financial incentive for me. And I want to make sure that that doesn't jade your decision-making process. And that honesty pays itself in spades time and time again. You're totally right about that.
Absolutely.
Last question, and it's kind of a two-part question here, but I always ask all of my guests the idea of Dear Younger Me. You're writing yourself a letter, and you, if you could give yourself, impart some wisdom now as you're older to your 22-year-old self, it's the advice you wish you knew when you were 22. So as you're mentoring someone, maybe you might give this advice. But what's something that you would say today to the younger Kira and say, you know, here's the advice that I'd have to give to you? And that's the first part of the question. Second is, what type of legacy do you want to leave?
Yeah. So, you know, to the younger me, I would say, think bigger sooner. and don't be so afraid to do things on your own. I often brought in partners just because I was afraid to do something by myself. I think women in general are more collaborative. We feel more comfortable working with teams, but I think any new investor likes the idea of having a partner. But generally that unless the partner really, really added value, I shouldn't have done it. I was dragging partners along instead of really finding people who were elevating my game because I was picking partners out of fear and thinking too small. So I would tell myself to think bigger and, you know, expect more from others, like expect more of a contribution earlier on. And then as far as my legacy, I mean, it's my boys. I mean, I just, I think constantly about, you know, when you set yourself out to try to create financial freedom and independence for your children, the flip side of that you have to consider is you don't want to create entitled, bratty little pieces of poop. And so, you know, figuring out that balance in the legacy, creating enough wealth that my boys have access to maybe skipping the first step of scraping it all together and can build upon what I've built. Doesn't have to be in real estate, but in whatever their passion and their heart is for making a contribution to the world. But making sure that that's instilled in them before they have access. One of my friends said, you know, he told his kids early on, he said, if you're good people, there's a lot of money there for you to, you know, and I'm going to support you. And he said, if you're not, I have no problem donating it all to charity. you know, and another friend of mine in real estate, you know, said, you know, his kids are in the best private school. They've done a lot of good things, but one of the places they always try to, you know, calibrate their children is in when they travel. So for a special holiday, they pulled up to, you know, a 5-star resort, and he said he and his wife were so proud, and they looked at each other and said, you know, we did a good job, because they pulled up, their kids looked around and said, don't unpack. There's no way we're staying here. You know, they'd been, you know, they stay at, you know, 2-star, 3-star hotels when they travel, even though they could afford to do much, much more. You know, so making sure that my children are well calibrated to reality, that they come from service, and then that they have the resources to really catapult that service in the next generation. That's the legacy.
Yeah, two thoughts I have on that, and that's phenomenal, is that, you know, there's a lot of people that talk about, I just want to raise good kids. And it's like, I heard a speaker say this once, that it's not about raising good kids, it's about raising mature adults. And yes, a lot of times, if you have a good kid, you're pacifying them with whatever, instead of teaching them the lessons that they need to learn on their own. Then the second thing that I've heard, and this is actually an inscription on the British 2-pound coin, it says, standing on the shoulders of giants. And I work with a lot of wealthy individuals in the real estate industry, and I've found that great families do a very intentional job of passing on wealth, and they realize that their children are going to have a step up. They're going to be literally standing on their shoulders. But that's a very dignified thing, and it's very honorable. And I'm a person of faith, and I actually believe that that is something that is your duty as a parent, is to yes, leave a legacy to your children and your children's children. And I've done a lot of work around that subject, so I love both of your answers. Well, we're short on time, and I definitely appreciate Kira Golden's time from Direct Source Wealth. As a lot of the podcast observers, whether you're on YouTube or listening on iTunes, know that I'm learning along with you, and I have learned so much. I've taken so many notes, and I'm going to re-listen to this podcast. This has been phenomenal. But as a gift, I give all of my podcast guests a book, and I felt like this was really apropos. You have developed a great team, and so I'm giving you a book by one of my favorite authors named Patrick Lencioni called The Ideal Team Player. Now, if you're looking on YouTube, it's kind of hard to see because it's reversing that, but The Ideal Team Player actually basically creates three core tenets of what makes an ideal team player, and it's not the all-star. It's the person who is humble, hungry, and smart, and it's a combination of those three things, and they show a Venn diagram where those all overlap, and it shows, it's really cool, there's a methodology in the book that talks about, if someone's hungry and humble but not smart, what does that mean? And if they're smart and humble but not hungry, what does that mean? And it's a phenomenal book about, awesome, working with teams. So I think you'll really like it, and I'll send that over to you. But to close out the show, for Kira Golden, my client, and hopefully we do a lot more deals together. It's been so much fun working with you today on the podcast. I'm Kyle Malnati, the host of the Calibrate Real Estate Podcast. Check us out on YouTube. Check us out on iTunes. Thank you so much for your download. And as I love to say, we will see you around the neighborhood. Bye, everybody.
Bye. Thank you.